You know, you can change the meaning of a symbol or assign a new verbal symbol to a reality, but you can't change the meaning of a fixed reality. If I say a dog is now a truck, so that certain four-legged creatures are now known as trucks as well as certain four-wheeled vehicles, I've not affected the reality of dogs or trucks in any way because these are fixed. And if I say a man and a woman can make a promise, and that is a marriage, and a man can make a promise, and that's a marriage in the same way, then what I've done is I've assigned the same verbal symbol, marriage, to two different realities. Now, I know there are some legal, civil implications for that name change, but those, even those civil legal factors, they're not really fixed realities. They're culturally determined, like marriage filing jointly, etc. So you can call a canine a truck, and you can call an F-50 a truck, and you'll create confusion, but you can't, in so doing, alter the fixed reality of something by messing with verbal symbols. God, the Scriptures, the Gospel, our faith, these are fixed realities, and they're not mere symbols without any reality-based substance. I was reading about Andy Warhol this week. He was famous for his symbolism. Pop artist who died in 1987. To my amazement, his paintings have sold for over $100 million. And he was an openly and aggressively immoral man, but he was also said to be a very religious man, very consistent in going to church. And he often used religious motifs in his works. At the same time, his parties were infamous, and his works were sometimes pornographic. So how do you make sense of those inconsistencies in his life? Well, he was a man of symbols, and symbols were reality for him. So going through the motions of church, the symbolic aspects of church attendance was important, but the symbolic actions did not influence his real life in substantial ways. And symbols are powerful. Symbols are powerful when they remind us of substantial realities. This is a powerful symbol. But it's only a powerful symbol because it represents a real marriage. Baptism is a very powerful symbol, but by itself, if it was not tied to actual rebirth, then the symbol itself would be without substance. Warhol seemed to have concluded that life was merely symbolic. There was nothing permanent, unchanging, and fixed. And so his art was built around largely cultural symbols. Some of his more famous works were these stylized pictures of paintings of Marilyn Monroe, a can of soup. But those paintings were about the symbolism of cultural icons divorced from substantial reality. He loved the symbolism of Hollywood. And he was aware that there was really no substance there. He said, I love Hollywood. They're beautiful. Everybody there is plastic. He said, but I love plastic. He said, I want to be plastic. And he really lived like a plastic man. He turned his own life into a mere symbol. So that's how he could be at one hand very religious, at the same time live a life completely at odds with the very religion he claimed. And without a fixed point of reference, you can't navigate life. So an N, a W, an S, and an E, those are letters that are symbols. And the reason why they're very helpful and powerful is because if you're lost, those letters, those symbols, represent a real world in which there's a north, south, east, and west. So we don't live in a world that's merely a collection of symbols. We name things, but naming things does not make things. And renaming them does not unmake them. And Jesus is who he is. Some say he's one thing. Someone says another thing. But all that matters is who he really is. And today we're going to see where he's going to ask people, he's going to ask his followers, who are people saying that I am? He's not doing a poll to feel the pulse of the people to see how to run his campaign for Savior of the world. It really doesn't matter what people think. It only matters what really is. And he's trying to make sure he's aligning his disciples' view of who he is with what really is true. See, it doesn't matter what we believe is true about the world. It only matters if what we believe about the world is true. And the passage we're going to read this morning is a turning point in the Gospel of Mark. It's about the halfway point in terms of the verses, chapter 8. And it's a point in which Mark is going to, it's like you go on a run and you've run out from the house and you're turning and going back towards home. Mark's making the turn and heading back towards home. But home, in this case, is going to be the cross. The first half of the book focuses on the Lord's ministry to the crowds. Lots of signs and miracles pointing to Jesus as the king. The second half is going to focus on his ministry to the disciples. Going to be a lot fewer miracles. And the narrative is going to move pretty quickly to the last week of the Lord's life. In fact, one-third of the book of Mark is 1 week in the Lord's life. 1 week out of 33 years is going to be one-third of his book. Someone said that Mark's gospel is a long introduction to the story of the cross. So the news section opens with a two-stage healing of a blind man, and it's the only two-stage healing that we have in Mark's gospel. And this incremental coming of sight to the blind man points to the incremental coming of spiritual sight to his disciples. Mark chapter 8, verse 22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." And once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And Jesus sent him home saying, "Don't go into the village." So in this turning point narrative, a blind man is brought to the Lord by other people. It doesn't seem to indicate that the man initiated on his own. His friends initiated. His friends came, and they're the ones who begged Jesus to heal him. He didn't beg for himself. And maybe it's demonstrating that his faith is not quite there. Maybe he's feeling hopeless. Maybe he's asked God for years to heal his blindness, and so he needs his friends to carry the hope for him. And last week we looked at how we're unable to be resilient all by ourselves. It's not how God designed the world. And here again we see this same theme where this man needs his friends. You know, on the one hand, we have to own our own faith. We can't live off the faith of other people. On the other hand, there are times when our own courage and faith is running small. And we need other people to have courage and faith for the both of us. And I've been on both sides of that. You probably have too. Been times when I've been carried by the courage and faith of others. And there have been times when others have needed me to play that role for them. So don't dismay. You do need to own your faith. But don't dismay the fact that there are times when God's going to provide battle buddies for you who are going to carry the courage and the faith for you during those times. So the others bring this man to Jesus. They beg for healing for him. And the Lord leads the man out of the village in order to establish personal contact with him, gets him away from the crowds. And the man's faith was going to grow incrementally, just like his healing was going to grow, going to happen in stages. And the healing was going to be manifested externally, but what the Lord was doing for this man was something going on inside of his heart. The same thing would be true for the disciples. They're going to understand who the Lord is incrementally. The Lord was doing something inside of them that was going to show up on the outside of them. You know, more and more, I think, life is being lived externally. And it seems like the inner world of people is shriveling up. And part of it is the inner world is being consumed by the drive to project everything external to us, to post everything external. Everything that happens in us, we invite the outside world to witness in near real time. So others are brought into our experiences as well as our understandings of those experiences with little time to process those experiences ourselves. I read this, I thought this 30 seconds ago, brand new insight from me. I think I'll post it for the whole world to see. Now this is not an anti-social media rant. Social media is neutral. It's like money, it's like fire, it's what you do with the fire or the money or what it does to you. I'm advocating watching your heart in these matters because there are some subtle traps in letting the inside of you shrivel up. And you say, well, people are posting their deep thoughts and their deep feelings, and that's okay. But what happens is that process of what God's doing inside of us can get corrupted if the first thought is God reveals something to us, God speaks to us, and our first thought is, how do I tell other people, rather than, God, what are you saying? You know, what are you really doing inside of me? Watchman Nee, a Chinese Christian that was killed for his faith many years ago, said, if you learn a new truth, live it for a year, if you still believe it, then teach it. Now it'd be an improvement to wait an hour when you learn a new truth, I think. So when we live without a private world, I think our spirits begin to atrophy like an unused muscle. In the World War II movie Saving Private Ryan, the character played by Tom Hanks, who's the leader of this little army squadron, he's finally going to let his guys into part of his private world. And it's the private world that sustains him through difficulties. And he's doing this strategically to help these people. Not to help himself, but to help his little squadron. And so he starts telling them the inner world that sustains him, and by telling him some stories of his home and his wife. And they ask him to elaborate some more on a particular story. He says, no, that's for me. That's just for me. And when there's none of that in our relationship with God, there's no insights, no interactions with God that are just for me, then the authenticity of our interactions with God can become, I think, corrupted over time. Like the woman I read about who was so busy taking pictures and videos of her children, thousands, tens of thousands, that she was completely missing her children's lives. And I can imagine God saying, I didn't give you that so you look good online or smart to your friends or spiritual or to invite the whole world. That was for you and that was for me. Now, don't over apply this. Our experience with God is to be shared. But I'm sure that Jesus wants some interaction with you or me and you and me that's just for you and just for me and him. And so when the Lord heals a man, he's going to tell him, go straight home, avoid the village. Why? The man hadn't even had time to process this yet. If he goes walking through the village, hey, what's going on? And he's a blind man walked out, and then a sighted man walks in, there's going to be a lot of questions. He didn't even know, he wouldn't even know fully how to answer those questions. He hadn't processed it yet. So the Lord said, don't go through the village, go straight home. His understanding was going to need to mature a little bit. Look at the healing, like the deaf man where the Lord used sign language. Here he's going to use tactile emphasis for this blind man. He's going to put his hands on the man. He's going to use the moisture of his own spittle so the man can feel the Lord's interaction with him. The Lord doesn't say, there, you're healed, which he could have done, but he says, okay, do you see anything? And the man says, I can see something, but not yet clearly. Now, I'm telling you, at this point, when the man can see a little bit, I promise you, his heart was thump, 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 thump. He didn't say, I can't see clearly. What's the deal, Jesus? His heart was thumping. He's like, I can see something. I can see something. I think it's people. They look like trees walking around. Yeah, it's people, all right. And so he's starting to hope. See, Terry, you're making this up. This is a real person, a real event. You don't have to make this stuff up. Just think about it. What would happen to you if you're blind and you get touched by Jesus and all of a sudden you see, all start seeing some shapes walking around? You're going to get excited. Your expectancy factor is going to start going up. He's not going to need his friends anymore. His experience is going to be enough for his own faith. And then the Lord touches him again and he sees clearly. He's healed, sent straight home. Because just like the physical healing was gradual, his understanding of God's purposes of this are going to be gradual as well. Go sit with this for a while. And now the Lord is going to turn his full attention to his little squadron who's watching this. He's going to take them on a long walk from Bethsaida to Caesarea Philippi, which is going to be several days' walk. It's just like he took the blind man away from everybody, he's going to take his boys on a long walk. He's going to start focusing his attention more fully on them. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked him, who do people say I am? He said, well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, some say one of the prophets. What about you? Who do you say I am? Peter said, well, you're the Christ. And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. So as they walked, the Lord says, who do people say I am? Don't confuse this with a desire for affirmation posed as a question. Sometimes we ask a question similar to this, and we want affirmation, not information. So what are people saying about my talk my work I did? Meaning, do people like me? How did I do? Am I okay? The Lord didn't play those games. He didn't have to. He was completely confident in who he was. So this question was for their instruction. It wasn't for his own ego. And they begin to answer the question based on their observations. Now, stop and think about this again. I think in our minds sometimes we think, okay, the Lord met his disciples and then 3 years later he died on the cross and then sent him and rose from the dead and sent him out. And during that 3 years period of time, it was just like a 3-year deployment. They lived together 24/7. This is all happening in a pretty small geographic area. They're going home, they're coming and going, they're not together all the time. And so when they replied, well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, some say one of the prophets, are saying, well, you know, when I was home last weekend, my mom said, you're John. My high school buddy, he thinks you're Elijah. Well, the leaders in my home church / synagogue, they give you credit for being a prophet. They say, you're not on par with Elijah. And these guys were at the time kind of minor celebrities. They were hanging out with Jesus, the one who was becoming both infamous and famous. And these guys were his entourage. they're going to find out soon enough that following Jesus is not going to make them famous as much as it's going to cost them. It's going to demand all that they are. But when they understand who he is, which is happening incrementally, he truly is the famous one, not just localized fame in time and space, but famous in all of creation, they're going to care very little for personal fame. But that day hadn't come yet. They're still seeing Jesus like trees walking around. So the main idea of who Jesus is, he's John, he's Elijah, he's some lesser prophet. And the very ideas of who Jesus is tell us at least two things about how people perceived him. One, we can get rid of the image of Jesus as this soft-spoken, soft-living sort of guy, sort of walking around in a perpetually clean white robe, even though he's walking on dirt, hair shining with salon-quality conditioner on it. We can get rid of that idea. They say he's Elijah or John the Baptist. These were rough and tumble fellas. They spoke very directly. They lived very, very difficult, kind of austere lives. And so he's no pansy. He's a prophet. So that's what they see him as. So first, that'll help you shape your image of who Jesus was perceived to be. But second, nobody was throwing around the idea that he was the Messiah. In spite of all that had happened, they thought he was just one more forerunner, like Elijah, like John, like the other prophets, who were speaking of the one to come, but nobody was yet seeing him as the one who had come. But he's not really that concerned with the ideas of the crowds. He's most interested in how the disciples' ideas of who he was were going to contrast with that of the prevailing narrative around them, because the day is going to come when they're going to be sent out and they're going to be asked to go and proclaim the truth of who he really is, and it's going to run counter to the multiple prevailing narratives about who he is. Happens to us today. So he said, okay, they say I'm a prophet, but what about you? You're my closest friends. Who do you say I am? And Peter pipes up and says, well, I think you're the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah. And the Lord simply says next, don't tell anybody. Doesn't that seem a little odd? Well, I think it's partly because, as we'll see next week, Peter is seeing Jesus as a tree walking around. He's like the blind man. He's not seeing him clearly. This is the first touch. It's going to be incremental. He's going to need a few more touches. The day's going to come when they're going to see Jesus clearly, and the Lord at that time is going to say what? Everywhere you go, tell everyone you come in contact with who I am. But they're not there yet. They haven't seen him clearly yet. In addition, that once it becomes clear to more clear to the people in charge of the culture at that time who he really is, who he's claiming to be, it's going to become increasingly dangerous for him and for them. And he's going to the cross, there's no doubt about that, but he's going to go according to his own time schedule, not of someone else. So from the incremental sight of the man with the physical blindness to the incremental sight of his guys with their spiritual blindness, Mark's gospel has turned the corner and it's now heading straight for the cross. Because it's at the cross and at the empty tomb where the boys are going to finally see clearly. That's when they're not going to see Jesus like trees walk around, they're going to see him as he really is. So our growth in faith is about aligning our beliefs, our hearts and minds with what is true and real. And this is internal before it becomes external. And what we're believing internally will always find its way into our external lives. Growth in believing and living what's true is going to start internally, move externally, but it's always going to be, most often going to be incremental, not exponential. Before we look at these facts, let's revisit our introduction. We have to embrace the reality behind the verbal and the other visual symbols that we use. When we talk about God and Jesus and the gospel, we're not just using verbal symbols to make ourselves feel a certain way. We're using verbal symbols like J-E-S-U-S, the letters that form the word Jesus, which is a verbal symbol that talks about a fixed reality. Jesus in the real world, the eternal Savior of the world. So it's really important that we resolutely think real, not just symbolic, when we consider these applications. Because when you think real, your mind thinks and your life goes a certain way. When you think symbolic, then your mind and your life goes a different direction. If you think real, you're going to consider the implications and applications. You're going to think of potential barriers and problems. You're going to consider what part of those realities is going to be more challenging. With mere symbols, you can just sort of feel what you feel about symbols, and you're done. With reality, you have to align yourself with it, or it'll align you with it. And people tend to talk symbols and feel symbols, but we live substance. And our faith is very often relegated to the world of symbols without substance. And so we have to work really diligently to get over this. If we don't, it creates dysfunction like we saw in Andy Warhol's life. It's a life at odds with itself. It's a spiritual autoimmune disorder where you believe one thing, think one thing, and live another thing, and so they attack each other and consume your life. It's the same reason why many, you've heard the stories of children growing up in youth group, kids growing up and teenagers growing up, and then they go off and they jettison their faith. It's not because the faith became unreal or they were taught fairy tales when they were younger. It's because there was this disconnect. They grew up buying into symbols, and they didn't understand that the symbol pointed to a substance. My wife is right here. This is a symbol of a real thing. And so they got trapped or tripped over the symbols. Just another way of talking about the two-story approach to life we've talked about so often. Upstairs is a world of symbols, downstairs is a world of substance, the real world. So let's look at some applications from our passage. Growth in faith is always going to be internal before external. And I don't want to belabor the whole living to post theme. There's nothing wrong with posting your thoughts, your feelings, etc. online or telling other people. And don't be afraid that Terry's going to judge you because I won't see him anyway, so don't worry about it. And in fact, clearly it's a good thing to share what God is doing in you. My point is we need to give attention to what God is doing in us. We need to pay attention to the authenticity of what's going on inside of us, and sometimes that process can be corrupted by this immediate desire to make sure everybody knows that something real is going on inside of me. If something real is going on inside of you, trust me, people will know. We don't want to grow in order to look a certain way to others. This is not real growth. Let me read a passage out of Matthew 6. Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by them. If you do, you'll have no reward from your Father in heaven. When you give to the needy, don't announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets to be honored by men. I tell you the truth, they've received the reward in full. But when you give to the needy, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so your giving may be done in secret. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites, for they like to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by men. I tell you the truth, they've received the reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, pray to your Father who's unseen, and your Father who sees what's done in secret will reward you. This is not about you should never let anybody know if you give, you should never pray in public. The Lord prayed in public. This is not about a new set of rules. This is about paying attention to what's going on inside of you. Give to the needy, don't let your left hand or even Facebook know what your right hand is doing. The hypocrites, which was a word for actors in a play, so that the actors in this religious play do what they do for the applause of people, and that's all they get, and that's not much. What if you could have a deep relationship with God instead? Nothing of substance is happening inside of them because everything happening inside of them only had one goal, to look a certain way on the outside. But when we pay close attention to what's happening inside of us, then something substantial is going to happen on the outside of us. So he's saying, when you pray, don't make a show of it. Have something substantial that's just between you and God. Second application, growth in faith is most often incremental rather than exponential. So we hope for huge jumps, growth that comes in leaps and bounds, and there are certain times for certain people when they experience accelerated growth spurts, but this is just some of the time. And not even for everybody. The norm is incremental, steps of growth. And what happened to this blind man and the disciples was descriptive, not prescriptive, meaning that the gospel was being unfolded. They were living in that time. Now, we live after the gospel has been completely unfolded. It's done. We can look back, and it's not being revealed incremental anymore. But an application for us is that God, in our own spiritual growth process, is going to reveal himself incrementally. It's going to be a process. And we need to make peace with that. We need to be okay with that. We can get impatient with ourselves or with God, and we want to accelerate the growth. We'd like to skip the pressure cooking aspect of growth in faith and just get to a microwave growth in faith. But we're not going to get to the right conference, read the right book, have the right experience, get the right mentor. It's going to completely accelerate our growth and take away the need for step by step by step. And we need to embrace that reality. This is the norm. So don't get sidelined by a focus on symbolism without basis in reality. Be relentless in asking the question, what do I do with this? How do I think about this and believe this in the real world? Don't just merely be comfortable with having a feeling about God or the Scriptures or about life. Warm fuzzies about the feelings. Feelings are great if you have a feeling about God. You feel joy, you feel anger, you feel dismay. That's great. Read the Psalms. We're going to read the Psalms all next year, so you'll be reading the Psalms then. And they feel things. They feel things deeply, but they move to action. Even a feeling about God. This is a real God. I have a real feeling. If I feel anger towards Ernest or joy towards Ernest, it has implications and applications for our real life. It's not just a feeling floating out there in the Neverland. What are you going to do? Be relentless in thinking about your faith in terms of how do I actually do this? And then real change starts internal. Pay close attention to this fact. Post to your heart's content, but be careful that you pay attention to the fact that your goal is growth on the inside, not to maintain an external image, but something substantial is happening on the inside. And I'm not talking about keeping people out of your heart. Don't misapply this. But I'm saying that if we don't discipline our own minds to say, God, I want something real to happen between you and me, and I don't care if anybody knows this. And if we move through life thinking, boy, that was kind of a deep thought. I can't wait to tell someone about that. I actually had a sacrificial motive there. I want to tell someone about it. It corrupts the process. We struggle with that. And don't get caught in guilt over this. C.S. Lewis talked about how sometimes in the Screwtape Letters, how the chief demon would get people caught in a loop to where they start feeling humble, and then they start feeling proud for their feelings of humility. And he said, but don't tell the demon, don't take that too far, because pretty soon they'll just see how ridiculous this is and move on. So don't get caught in an inner trap. My point is that what's going to matter the most is this authentic personal relationship between you and God on the inside of you. And I assure you, if that's happening, it's going to show up on the outside of you. And then real change is incremental. Make peace with this. If you experience a jump in faith, rejoice. But most often, you're going to experience steps of faith. This week, a friend I was in dialogue with apologetically said to me, I'm sorry that I've kind of gotten off in my thinking again, because we talked about perspective. And my response to this friend was, we all leak perspective. All of us leak perspective. And we like to think that we're sort of a holding tank where we can just get filled up and we're just good to go. But we're not. We're a pipeline. Or we're like a sieve. We're just, there's holes in us and we leak. But thank God, He's a river. And He keeps flowing perspective and life into us. So don't be dismayed that you need God and you need others consistently in order to maintain perspective. You're going to. Let's pray together. Once you talk to God for a moment about your heart, your life, your perspective, if you feel a lot of guilt, if you feel remorse over failures from this last week or from the past, then would you take those to Him? The feelings are real, but so is the forgiveness that He offers you. Would you take those to Him right now?